Hi there. You're listening to Policy Streams, a podcast where we have casual conversations with our friends on their policy interests. I'm Bernard Min.
And I'm Jamie Soon.
And we're your hosts on Policy Streams. So Jamie, tell me what's on for today's podcast.
Okay, yeah. All right. Today we've got our friends Abe from Indonesia and Ankush from Singapore, both international relations experts of Southeast Asia.
And what are they going to be talking about today?
They'll be taking us through an international relations strategy known as soft power and how it's being exercised in Southeast Asia. Welcome, Abe and Ankush. How are you guys doing?
I'm good, Jamie. Thanks. How are you?
I'm good.
And how are you going, Ankush?
Yeah, I'm good too. Good to be here.
I might start with you, Abe, on this podcast. Where has this pandemic taken you in this time?
I'm now in Jakarta. Yeah, now I have time with my family. But of course, I miss you guys, especially for those who's in Singapore.
Are you planning to come to Singapore anytime soon, or you love Jakarta more than you love us?
I don't know, man. It's a mixed feeling. I want to be with you guys, but also with my family. So let's see.
Hey, Abe. So what are you enjoying most right now in Jakarta?
Since the summer, I'm helping the ADB Indonesia. They're now helping the Indonesian government to develop the financial inclusion roadmap until 2024. So I did some research assistantship, talked to people from the Central Bank, Financial Services Authority, Ministry of Economic Affairs, try to see what's their priorities for the next 4 years. It's exciting, new stuff. I learned a lot. But in general, it's a totally productive summer, and I really enjoyed it.
And so what about you, Ankush? Did you get up too much during the summer break?
Yeah, man. So I did a couple of sort of part-time internships to keep myself busy. And it was interesting because, you know, actually, in a way, the working from home situation allowed for some sort of flexibility. So I managed to juggle a few things here and there. So it was like an internship with like a chamber of commerce and then with like another one with like a think tank. I feel like I maybe should have taken some time off though. Once school started, it's pretty insane. As productive as we want to be, we should probably just relax a bit over the holidays as well.
I 100% agree with you, Ankush. But back to you, Abe. The work that you did with the ADB and financial inclusion sounds fascinating. But it's not exactly what you were doing before you came to the LKY school. Can you let us in on your background?
Yeah. So my academic background is actually international relations. I did IR for my bachelor degree. Then I joined the government for 1.5 years at the Ministry of Development Planning before joining the ASEAN Secretariat for 5 years. So during my time in the ASEAN Secretariat, most of my works are related to policy monitoring and evaluation, especially in terms of economic cooperation. So mostly about international trade, then investment. It's more on IR actually.
Well, IR is kind of sounds like what you were doing over more recently in your professional career, but I understand you're once upon a time an educator as well. Is that kind of your secret past? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So long time ago, it's 10 years ago, damn, I feel so old now. So when I was a university student, to graduate, you have to finish your mini thesis and do community service. And for my community service, I went to remote area in Maluku. It's on the eastern part of Indonesia and nearby the Philippines. We did some community activities with the seaweed farmers, but we found out that there were no teachers available in that area. So the school is there, available there with the students there, but there was no teacher. So sometimes between our community service, we have to become a teacher for them for 3 months. And actually, it's an exciting stuff for us. I mean, it's never in our imagination to become a teacher, but we did that, yeah.
Were you teaching something specifically or anything and everything?
So I studied IR, right? So living in a rural area, then I'm thinking, what can I teach to these students? So I teach geography, bringing them the map, trying to show the simple stuff like Indonesia is so big. This is Jakarta. This is your place and how to get there. Sometimes I also teach English, but sometimes I also teach civic education and math.
I see. That's such an interesting background, Abe. Right now, I'm aware of someone else on this call who also came from somewhere other than Singapore, and it's Ankush. Ankush, so can you talk a little bit about the background before you coming to Singapore?
I've been in Singapore for about 10 years now. Prior to this, I mean, I was born and raised in India, and so I grew up in sort of the western part of India. So I was born in Bombay, but more lived in a city which is about 2.5 hours drive away from Bombay, which is like a big educational city in India. And yeah, so I grew up there and I was there for about almost close to 19 years. And so when I was about 16, this is like after high school in India, I sort of applied for this year-long exchange program that's been like funded by the sort of American State Department. And it's quite an interesting program to reach out to students from across the world to sort of build cultural relations and bring these students to the United States so that they could experience like American culture and life. And so how it works is like you're placed with actually a host American family and you essentially live as like a member of the family. You attend school there for 1 year, depending on what your age is. And yeah, and then you essentially sort of become this sort of cultural ambassador, I guess, for your country for a year.
So where in the U.S. were you staying?
So I was with this family in outside of Phoenix in Arizona, which is on the sort of western United States. And I went to this, this is a very interesting kind of difference from what I was used to, because it was actually a Catholic preparatory high school. And it was, I would like to say it was sort of in a very affluent area. And so it was all these very affluent sort of Americans who were attending the school, because it was a private school. It wasn't a publicly funded school.
Would you say you had a good time while you're there?
I really enjoyed my time there because the family was very nice. They really took me in as one of their own and, you know, integrated me into all their family events and cultural stuff that they did. And even the school, I think, because they allowed me to join like the football team, try out different American sports, be a part of the musical there that year. So I really felt like I got a very true American high school experience for that year. So yeah, it was very interesting. And then I came back from there. Then I was in India for basically my junior college years, which was 2 years.
How did this transition from the US or from India to Singapore happen?
When I was in the United States, my father had been transferred to Singapore for work. And so we sort of made the family decision to move to Singapore, all of us together. And so after my 2 years of study in India, I came to Singapore. And then I had to do like basically military service here for 2 years. And after that, then I became a Singaporean.
What age did you move to Singapore?
I was 19, I believe.
And yes. from 19 years old, you came in, and then immediately then you had to go do the military service?
Yeah, pretty much. So we had applied as a family to become like permanent residents in Singapore. And at the time that they interviewed us for the permanent residency, they actually mentioned this. They said that, you know, for me and my brother, because we were in that age group to do national service, I think they called us in for military service pretty quickly after that. So I moved to Singapore, I think, in April 2011. And I was enlisted in the army on, I think it was 8th of September 2011. So
wow,
basically 5 months.
Your memory is excellent, Ankush. No, but yeah. I remember we had this conversation because now you're like, what, 28? Is it?
Yeah,
28, right? And so you've really spent quite many years in Singapore as well. And I remember having this conversation with you in Surabaya on the bus, and we're talking about identity, about how you felt, you know, growing up in India, but also having spent so much time in Singapore and, you know, seeing the difference between the two countries and feeling, I won't call it an identity split, but a difference in identity, which was interesting.
What I'm surprised about is that when you came to Singapore, within 5 months of being here, you had to serve in the army. How did you feel about your identity? If I were you, I'd still identify myself as an Indian national. But now, coming to a new country, you had to serve for a nation you might not identify with.
Yeah. No, that's a really great question. And I don't think it I thought about it all that much at that time because I saw it as a very sort of, you know, something that I had chosen to do. But I do remember one thing, which is for the permanent residents, so on the very first day of the service, the day you enlist, they had this sort of queue and they asked you straight up whether you wanted to apply for Singapore citizenship or whether you intended to apply for it. And if you did want to apply, then you could actually sign your name over there and then you could sort of apply for it through the army. And that's like, I mean, I found it very interesting that on the very first day of military service, they just give it to you straight. You know, it's like a choice that you're being asked to make on that day itself. And I'd obviously discussed that with my parents and, you know, we had agreed that we are putting down our roots in Singapore. We had decided to sort of live here permanently.
I'm presuming that you've never looked back.
What are you doing, Bernard? He's Singaporean now.
No, but I think it's a really great question because, you know, what Jamie mentioned as well, that these questions of identity, you know, about nationality and ethnicity, I think, are the two main things that you have to look at. And what I like about Singapore is that even though nationality here is, obviously, we are Singaporean, but the ethnicity thing is so much more, is so much more like diverse here because you actually have what I think is a really great example of a multicultural society, right? With a couple of major groups represented and then some smaller groups as well.
But how do you reconcile that Indian ethnic identity with this new Singaporean citizen identity?
It took me a bit of time to sort of reconcile those. But I think now, over the course of time, I'm really comfortable with it. And I think it's basically a question of, you know, like it's why wouldn't you want to have like the best of two worlds, right? So you can love and enjoy Singaporean food. And at the same time, you can watch like Bollywood movies on the side. I see it as a very like, it's a really great like win-win for me because I get to like experience the best of these two cultures. And there is obviously some overlap in between with the Singaporean Indian community. But it's taken a bit of time, but I think I'm very comfortable in my identity now.
No, that's really good to hear. It's quite an interesting perspective as well. And I think my gut feel is this kind of international exposure that we've had, cross-cultural, multicultural, multiracial kind of exposures, is probably also what's raised your interest, I suppose, into international relations. And this is the reason why we're interviewing both you, Ankush, and you, Abe, as well, because both of you are international relations passionate people, especially in the ASEAN region. And I know, Abe, you've recently written a piece for the Jakarta Post around soft power diplomacy. I might give you a quick question, Ankush, just for the international relations noobs out there. Can you just kind of explain us the concept of soft power? What is it? Why would you do it?
Soft power is the opposite of, like, say, military and what they call hard power. And I believe it was coined by this academic, a very famous academic, Joseph Nye, who's a professor at Harvard. And the idea of soft power is that you get sort of countries to do what you want without physically coercing them. And so it's come to signify a broad range of activities and, you know, outreach that countries do. And so everything from culture, education, to sort of, you know, even economics to some extent is included in this.
So what's a country that does this well?
For example, the United States is generally considered to be the best at soft power simply because their culture is just so accessible and so widespread across the world. I mean, all the well-known brands in a lot of countries, a lot of them tend to be American. A lot of the content that we consume on in terms of movies and videos and TV shows are American. And so they generally just have that soft power outreach. And I think there's some countries that are actively pursuing this. And I think Abe is going to share about Indonesia's take on it.
So Abe, you also wrote this really interesting paper called Indonesia 8, New Tool for Diplomacy. And you discussed how right now for the Indonesia 8, it still remains very much a foreign policy strategy.
So last year I wrote an article about the Indonesia 8. Basically, it's a new initiative by the Indonesian government. As a developing country, usually we receive development aid from other countries, right? So from Japan, from USA, from Australia. But what's interesting here is that although Indonesia is still a developing country, they now try to shift this approach and try to give development aid to other countries.
So where is Indonesia distributing some of their aid to?
So some of the identified countries as the development partner here is the Pacific countries. So Nauru, Kiribati, Solomon Island, including those in ASEAN are identified as part of the Indonesian strategy in the Indonesia aid.
Is there any pushback on the fact that Indonesia is giving out development aid?
Domestically, some people would argue that why would we give those money to other countries while in fact we may still need that money. So that would be the starter for the discussion, I think.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I really like this quote that you had, which said, "Reimagining Indonesia's development aid should go beyond mere political rhetoric to offer more tangible impacts for taxpayers. If treated effectively, Indonesia aid could help assert Indonesia's economic diplomacy strategy and global leadership in promoting sustainability and democracy among developing countries." I think this is so important because Indonesia is Southeast Asia's largest economy, right? And so they really do have that positioning, and before, you know, positioning themselves as this great power as well, they do have some internal issues that they want to focus on. What would you say are some of the key internal issues that are most pressing, especially now, you know, given that we have COVID-19 raging? What are your thoughts on it?
Now with the COVID, definitely Indonesia has to prioritize its health sector, especially in terms of health infrastructure, vaccine availability, and later economic recovery. From what I understand, even on managing the epidemic, we're still struggling in managing that. So I think internally that will be the first and foremost priority. Yeah, domestically, there are still other issues that need prioritized: education, infrastructure, inequality.
I recently read in the Straits Times, you know, Indonesian President Jokowi has called to reboot the economy, and that a lot of this focus is going to be on improving food and energy security and on processing more natural resources within Indonesia itself. And I'm very excited about these developments. You mentioned earlier in the podcast that you've been having these meetings with the central banks and with the government. Do you have any insights as to what we can expect from Indonesia moving forward?
So I think for the economic recovery, the digital economic transformation will play an important role. Many of them will include digital financial services, making sure that more people have access to financial access. And by having access to those financial institutions, you will be able to get the assistance from the government. So digital transformation will play an important part. But beyond that, infrastructure, especially on internet and economic commerce, will still also need to be developed.
I think for Indonesia, you know, a large part of its work is involving agriculture, right? And so you have a lot of smallholder farmers. And during this COVID-19, I think what we saw was that we realized that the supply chain is very non-resilient to shocks, right? Like COVID-19. So if they were to have, you know, the ICT solutions available, they would be able to have that. They can have financial transactions on their phones. They can have internet connectivity that, you know, sources them, points them towards where they should be selling their produce, so on and so forth. And I think it would definitely help a lot. So yeah, really looking forward to seeing how Indonesia and you and your efforts, you know, can pay off on this front. Let's talk a little bit about soft power, Bernard.
Yeah, absolutely. So within the ASEAN region, there's a couple of strong players in the soft power space. So as a great example, I've read a book just exactly about the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, and that itself, the school, is quite a strong way to exercise Singapore's soft power in the region. And part of what the school does as well is offer a lot of scholarships to students within the ASEAN region as a way to get them on board to the Singaporean way of doing things in terms of policies, in terms of international relations, and several other areas. I'm just wanting to hear from you, Ankush, as well, on other trends that you've seen in terms of soft power in the ASEAN region. Who's kind of the big players here, and what you've seen them doing as well?
In terms of Southeast Asia, I think a couple of countries obviously have an advantage in terms of soft power, because that culture, or, you know, those, some aspects of those countries are have sort of benefited from globalization and regionalism. So I would say some like countries like Thailand, where, you know, Thai food or Thai culture is relatively well known across both Southeast Asia and across the globe, I would say. Yeah. One of the big things in soft power is the diaspora, and they are really ambassadors of your culture, right? And so you look at countries which have large diaspora populations across the globe, and you might usually find that those are the countries which have sort of better soft power projection in a way. Within Southeast Asia, definitely Thailand, Indonesia, Vietnam, even the Philippines, I would say.
What about here in Singapore, where it's a much smaller nation but punches above its weight in terms of its economy?
As you mentioned, Bernard, right, it's all about leveraging what you're best at. So Singapore, even though it's the smallest in size, it does have significant economic capacity. And so it basically leverages that really well to sort of project soft power. One good example, one sort of relatively recent example would be Singapore as a sort of neutral space for negotiations and high-level meetings, right? So hosting that very famous summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump 2 years ago really boosted Singapore's profile as this sort of destination for, you know, high-level meetings. And that is like a sort of tool in its soft power arsenal, I would say.
So regarding soft power, right, I've been watching these YouTube videos of China. There is this girl from China called Li Ziqi, I think. And she makes these beautiful, beautiful videos of her living, you know, in a village. And she's living that farmer life, but it's so beautiful. Like, I swear, it's gorgeous. And everyone is like, whoa, China is like that. And, you know, they have this fantasy-like notion of that kind of lifestyle. And I started like digging around a little bit, and I think we found some background on some evidence that that could be a form of China's soft power operating through her videos and YouTube videos and stuff like that. What do you think of these kind of soft power using YouTube, using influencers? Is this something that we should not underestimate?
No, I think that's, you've touched on a really important point, Jamie. I think something that basically the rise of social media, right, has sort of just amplified the soft power outreach of countries like tenfold over the last maybe 10 or 20 years. Because where earlier sort of this outreach had to be either through the diaspora or through actual governments and businesses doing it, now you have, you basically democratize that entire process and put that power into the hands of basically all your ordinary citizens, right?
So pretty much anybody with a smartphone, internet connection, and a social media account can be an ambassador for their country, right? So long as they have a massive following.
I see. You know who else is an influencer? Abe! He's got quite a following on social media and Twitter. Do you want to spread your Twitter social media, Abe?
Well, because on Twitter, I rant a lot and in Bahasa, so I'm not sure.
I was going to ask a cheeky question, like, Abe, how do you become an influencer? How do you gain so many followers?
I think it's because of demographic bonus. We have 200 million people in Indonesia. That's why it's easy to get to 1,000. So it's not really an influencer.
Wait, what? You have 2,000 followers? I don't even have 2,000 friends. Abe, so you're sure you don't want to share your social media following?
Abe, because you're too shy, we're going to put the link to your social media handle anyway in the podcast description for anybody who wants to follow you. But yeah, that's actually pretty much all we have time for today. Thank you so much, Abe and Ankush, for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us, guys. It was great.
Yes.
Thanks, guys.
To all our listeners, thanks for tuning in today to Policy Streams.
So join us next time as we speak to our next guest, Rachel Jui, on discrimination and stereotypes affecting the LGBTQ community and ex-offenders.